As a child, she would dissect snakes, collect buckets full of lizards to study. It's no wonder then that her college studies focused on biology and physical anthropology, which in turn led to her study of medicine. A Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Stanford University, she earned her BA in anthropology, then went on to receive her MD from the University of California, San Francisco. She completed her internal medicine residency in Honolulu, Hawaii, rough duty there, where she worked as a physician. Tess is the author of 8, count them now, 8 bestsellers, and in her free time, what free time, she continues to compile a weird biological facts file viewable on her webpage. We have a link up to that right now, www.tessgerritsen.com, and appropriately, the background to all her material appears to be black. Coincidentally, my favorite color. In a moment, Dr. Tess Gerritsen. Perhaps even the Alfred Hitchcock of the medical world. I don't know. Dr. Tess Gerritsen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, Art. And I have to say that is the best comment I've ever heard, that I was a female Art Bell. Is there a higher compliment?
There are. Tess, you know, you are a doctor, and doctors heal. Doctors promise to make things better, and at the very least not worse. And yet, somehow, your studies sort of turn to the dark side. I mean, a fascination with death, not life. Explain that.
You know, it's more a fascination with things that creep me out. And we all are. That's why you have so many listeners on your station. We all are fascinated by things that just freak us out. Yeah. I can trace it back to my childhood. My mother was an immigrant from China. And when we were growing up, really, her English was not so good. So she took us to horror films. That was the one thing she did understand about American culture. She loved American culture.
Well, horror crosses all cultural lines.
Yeah, because you don't need to know a lot of English to know that when Frankenstein's coming after you, it's a bad thing. So I spent most of my childhood, cowering in movie theaters and screaming as a five-year-old. So I think that from an early age, I was very aware of the dark side, and aware that when you opened up a room to a locked door to a room, that there was something bad behind that door.
So really, you were raised in the Chinese culture, weren't you, Doctor?
Yes. Well, my mother was very traditional, and like a lot of little Chinese girls, we all took piano lessons. We all were very good at school. We all got straight A's in class.
Yes.
So that was quite traditional.
And the expectation is that you become a doctor or a lawyer or something professional of some sort.
And that's exactly what it was. I think that if I had, been allowed to do my own thing, I might have actually gone into journalism, because
really?
I'm just curious about things, especially strange things.
You must have some insight then into the Chinese way of looking at things. I mean, the way we look at the paranormal, for example, or what we think of as a paranormal, or the strange stuff you talk about, versus the way the Chinese culture does. I've never had anybody explain that to me. Do they believe as we believe, or profoundly differently?
You know, I don't know enough about it, because I was raised so thoroughly in Western medicine. You know, in the belief that things can be proven, that there are double-blind studies that can show whether something works or not.
All science.
Yeah, and my understanding of Chinese culture is that it really believes more in sort of spiritual things.
Exactly.
Yeah, whether things are either cold or hot or yin or yang, and it's all, you get sick when things are out of balance. I think that's really kind of what summarizes, as far as I know, about Chinese medicine.
Up front. Doctor, and there aren't very many doctors. I interview countless doctors and scientists, and I ask many of them, do you believe in God? And most don't. Some are very concerned to even begin an answer to that, and you're welcome not to answer it. But being so immersed in science, There aren't too many physicians that express publicly a belief in God, are there?
I think that probably there are fewer physicians who believe in God than the general population. I mean, when you look at the poll numbers for Americans in particular, they say about 90 to 95% believe in a supreme being, whether, you know, it's God or some other form.
Right.
But physicians, I suspect, will be like scientists, and that'll be a little bit lower. And to answer your question, because I have actually...
You don't have to.
I have answered this question before on your show, and I always get into trouble, but I'll do it again.
Sure.
Which is, I consider myself an agnostic, simply because I feel that I like to see evidence of things, and faith is one of those things that requires no evidence. That's sort of like the definition of faith.
Well, would you describe yourself as perhaps spiritual in some sense?
You know, I think all human beings are spiritual in some sense. It doesn't mean we believe in a supreme being, but to me, spiritual means you have a sense of wonder about just being alive.
Well, for example, a patient is being operated on, and they're in anesthesia,
mm-hmm.
you know, deep into anesthesia, really out as far as the surgeon is concerned. And some surgeons just absolutely believe there's no way in hell this guy or gal lying on the table with me opening him up is hearing or understanding anything I'm saying. Some of the more spiritual surgeons are careful what they say during surgery because they know or think or believe or have faith that the patient can in some way understand at some subconscious level what's being said. I mean, if the guy above says, man, this guy, look at that bleeder, he's not going to make it.
Yeah, not a good thing to say.
Yeah. You think not?
I don't think you have to be spiritual at all to believe that patients can hear through anesthesia. I think it's just a matter of understanding, you know, neurological chemistry that there are some patients who do hear things. And perhaps anesthesia wasn't as deep as we thought it was.
Sometimes not at all. In fact, aren't there these horror stories?
Oh, yes.
Of people waking up in the middle of, gut heart bypasses and stuff like that?
Well, the worst stories I've heard have to do with kind of crooked anesthesiologists who are stealing drugs or stealing pain medications. There was one case of a gas man, as we call them, who would put them under lightly, and then he would paralyze them, which is normal. You know, you get a form of curare to keep your muscles totally relaxed.
Right.
So that when the surgeon opens you up, you want your muscles, they don't want them too tight. And these patients would wake up and they'd be paralyzed, and there was no way they could say or do anything to tell anybody they were in pain. So they would lie on that table and endure surgical procedures, you know, cutting everything else you can imagine, and would feel the whole thing. That to me is probably the most nightmarish thing I can imagine.
I would like to say that I cannot imagine it, except I went through it.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't wake up during a surgery, but when I was in the Air Force, I had a little thing in my left shoulder that wasn't so little, kind of a big bump. You know, it was a possible tumor, and they took me in and said, you know, we'll just open this up and pop it right out. You know, we'll do it with Xylocaine, and you won't feel a thing. It'd be easy. Well, I was 4 hours on the operating table. It went deep into my chest, and they started the Xylocaine, and they told me that they couldn't put me under general because they were already deep into my chest, and they were giving me all the Xylocaine they could. I bet I had 30-something or another's, and they said they couldn't put me under general, much as they would have liked to, and believe me, doctor, I felt every snip, clip, and cut.
Oh, that is a nightmare.
It was, but I was awake during the whole thing, so I can. But I can't imagine what it would be like to be anticipating your next conscious moment, you know, looking at flowers in the room or something, but instead, you know, you see the bright light, you see the hands moving, and you feel the sharp cutting.
Yes, and you're awake the whole time. Oh, and yet, it's such a terrible crime to imagine that a doctor would put a patient through that. Now, I mean, it doesn't, if you are a good anesthesiologist, it should not happen. Even inadvertently, because you're supposed to be monitoring blood pressure and pulse rate, and those things go up in pain. And when you see that happen on the monitor, you maybe think you dial up that anesthesia a little bit higher.
Well, listen, you're a doctor. Maybe you can tell me. The physician, and I ended up, you know, it was going to be a simple procedure. I had four or five doctors in there doing this thing to me by the time it was all over. They told me, again, that they could not give me general anesthesia because they'd given me so much xylocaine. Was that BS?
I don't. You know what? I'm not an anesthesiologist. It sounds a little strange to me, though.
Me too.
I would think that when you start getting in deep in there, you're causing so much stress to a patient, you really want to put them out.
I agree with you. Anyway, that's what they told me. I thought at the time, you know, that sounds, well, that'd be true. You know, the doctor, you believe doctors and...
Well, you know, the other question you have to ask is, was there an anesthesiologist in the room, or did they not want to call one in?
Yeah, see, I don't know. Gave me that BS story, and I have no idea some captain. And then to top the whole damn thing off, I worked in the hospital, and so when the report came back from Lackland Air Force Base, you know, the test on this stuff they took out of me, it came back and it was completely benign, but the doctor took me in there and told me I had 6 months. And then he cracked up and actually fell on the floor. We were pretty close. We all knew each other in the hospital, but I didn't think it was funny at all.
That isn't funny at all.
It wasn't, no. No.
I hope you never had to go back for anything else at that hospital.
No, that was it. That was enough. Anyway, these things do happen. People do wake up, and the trouble is you'd be paralyzed, right?
You'd be paralyzed, and then there is even a case of an anesthesiologist who tried to hide it by giving his patient a beta blocker, which suppresses the ability of your heart to speed up. That nobody else in the room knew that the patient was awake because they could not see the monitor and did not realize that the pulse should have been higher. But the patient's normal reaction of pain was muted because the anesthesiologist did that too.
This is going to be like a special place in hell for people
there
like that. I mean, if you believe in such thing.
Yeah, and I think he was just a drug addict.
There's really no end of material for you for writing books, is there, in this field?
No, there isn't. You know, I'm doing crime thrillers, but a lot of the fiction that I write about, I base it on true crime, things that have actually happened.
I did notice you kind of did start down that line of crime, more crime than medicine.
Well, I think it's because we're all fascinated by evil. And is there any better way to explore evil than with crime fiction? You know, what people do to each other, and that's the stuff that really freaks me out. And unfortunately, because of the subject matter, I am meeting a lot of very strange people, Art.
I bet you are.
I'm getting a lot of strange correspondence, and when I go out on book tour, I actually encourage people to tell me their own personal crime stories, because I'm always fascinated by it, and I'm getting some real doozies that make me come home with nightmares.
You want more of that material? I've got the audience for it.
Well, you know what? I would love to put out just tell your audience if they have any personal weird crime stories, let me know, because I collect these things. And by the way, while I'm on the radio with you,
yes.
I just want to say hi to the Coast writers. Say hello, and especially particularly to Tim, who has been corresponding with me. You have a lot of fans out there.
We do indeed. With police, there is the great blue wall, you know, if something internally goes wrong, there's the great blue wall. With physicians, there's a similar wall. It's probably white, I suppose, huh?
You mean to be protecting ourselves?
Yes. In other words, I just have always wondered how many people died, you know, due to the stupid mistake of some doctor or some surgeon, and it. You know,
it gets
covered up, you bet.
Well, I think it probably... I hesitate to give you details because this is somebody I know. He's an anesthesiologist who works in Texas.
Yes.
And he works at a hospital, and there are two surgeons that he works with in this hospital. One of them, he says, is fine. The other one, he says... The saying in this hospital is, if you send a patient to them, tell them to buy the coffin... Now, and they all know this person is incompetent.
Yes.
But I think that they are all concerned about getting sued for, they're hurting his reputation if they were to say anything.
And probably blackballed themselves.
And blackballed themselves. And this man who told me this story, he's just, you know, he just does the anesthesia. He does not want to get in trouble with the hospital.
Well, Tess, in the when you go into the military, you go through basic training, which basically strips away your personality and makes you subservient and makes you obey orders. And I think that as a doctor, when you go through medical school and then you're an intern, it's kind of the same psychological thing, isn't it?
It is, and well, there's another thing going on too. I think a lot of doctors feel that there, but for the grace of God, go I. Everybody makes mistakes. They all realize that, and maybe if they see a colleague make a mistake once, they're not going to say anything. But you know what? If I think that most doctors, I think that was the exception that about I was talking about that hospital in Texas. Most doctors, if they see somebody who is incompetent, who is doing bad things, who's losing patients, they are going to say something quietly to the hospital, and the hospital is going to, quietly withdraw their privileges.
Yeah, but that could take some time and some number of mistakes, right? And
it could, but that's really where medical licensing boards come into play.
Yeah, but there's politics, right?
There is, but you know what? Here in the state of Maine, my husband actually is the president now of the Maine Medical Association, and he is constantly doing reviews, quality assurance reviews. Whenever there is a complaint, they have a panel that includes not only doctors but also lay people, attorneys, and they decide whether the doctor did something wrong. And they're not at all shy about removing somebody's license.
How does one, in so many cases, discern between a bad decision and incompetence? In other words, a lot of times, given a set of, I don't know, the patient presents with this and that, they simply make a wrong diagnosis and give the patient the wrong thing, and the patient dies.
Well, that happens. And I think that what doctors do when they're on these evaluation boards is they look at what the original doctor was presented with. What was the evidence? And they think to themselves, could I have made this mistake? Or knowing what I know, would it have been clear what should have been done? And, it's really a matter of judgment of the particular panel that has been chosen to evaluate that case. It's the same thing with airplane mechanics or lawyers or anything else. You see something, you think that's really stupid. Then it's clearly a case of incompetence.
Well, lawyers can certainly tell you that there's some kind of white wall out there.
I think that there is to some extent because doctors work with each other. They're friends. They are all colleagues, and sometimes they just don't want to turn someone in.
As I say, the difference between an honest mistake and just a misdiagnosis and issuing the wrong medicine and actual incompetence, that would be one hard line to try and discern.
It might be, but I think that if it happens more than once, then every doctor is on alert, and they know. I had surgery recently, and before I chose my surgeon, what we would do is we would go around to our doctors we knew and said, if your wife needed this operation, which doctor would you send her to?
Oh, did you now?
We did, and it's because the same name kept coming back again and again, that was the one I chose.
So, when is death not really death?
this question actually came up in a news article that inspired my book, Vanish. Here's the real story. It was in the suburbs of Boston, and a young woman was found dead in her bathtub. And the state police were called, the fire and rescue team came, they found empty pill bottles on the floor and said, she had an accidental overdose. They zipped her into a body bag and sent her off to the morgue. And a couple hours later, she woke up and walked out, apparently completely healthy, and 6 months follow-up later, it was fine.
Oh, God. We get these stories every now and then. We really do. They're in the Associated Press, people waking up in morgues. Oh, God.
And, this it happens so often that I have a friend it happened to.
Oh?
He was lying on the gurney. They had just declared him dead of an arrhythmia. He was being wheeled down to the hospital morgue when the orderly bumped up against a doorway,
yeah.
And my friend woke up.
Uh-huh.
And the orderly turned right around and brought him back up to ICU. You know, it's such a common story that I actually did a search on LexisNexis looking for some examples of how often this happens.
I wonder if it ever happens to a coroner, you know, scalpel in hand, ready to begin the autopsy, and the eyes blink, and oh my God, that could kill a coroner.
It did. And you know this. It did once. In the 1980s in New York, there was a man who was about to be autopsied. And the doctor had the scalpel in hand and was about to make the cut, and the so-called dead man woke up and grabbed the doctor, and it was the pathologist who keeled over dead of a heart attack. I understand that the man who was supposed to be autopsied survived that. So it does happen, especially, I mean, I think it probably happened quite a bit that people were buried alive in the days prior to embalming.
Yeah, we've talked about that, of course, on past shows. But, I mean, how can we get it so wrong? There's a criterion, right, for declaring somebody dead. They check this and that, hopefully. I mean, pulses and respiration and, you know, everything. So how do we get it wrong?
Well, in the case of the girl in the bathtub, she had taken an overdose of medications that probably depressed her respiration so that you could not see them very well. And whoever was listening to her heart, who knows what happened? I don't know how they could have missed it. But it does happen. And I can tell you as a doctor that it's not that out of the question that if you are in a very noisy room, if you have a lot of relatives who are crying around you, that maybe you don't hear the heart as well as you should. Or you don't watch long enough to see whether there are any respirations.
Speaking of that, when somebody codes, that is to say, I guess, when they code, their heart stops, they stop breathing, they are more or less dead, right?
Yes, and I mean, if you were to check somebody's vital signs at that moment, they would appear dead, even though their brain cells may still be alive.
Okay, so many times the paddles are applied and they're brought back, right?
Yes.
Are all patients who go through that, who code, are they told about it always?
Afterwards?
Yes.
Oh, they all know about it. I mean, we always tell them, we had a hard time with you yesterday. Your heart stopped. I mean, I think that they all know about it.
Okay, I always wondered.
and the other case in which you may not know it is drowning in cold water. I don't know if you're aware of it.
I am. The lowering of the body temperature, I guess?
It's a diving reflex. It turns out that this is such a primitive part of our brains. I mean, it probably goes back evolutionarily to when we emerge from the oceans, possibly. But especially with children, if you are to submerge them in cold water and bring them back out, they will look dead. They will not be breathing. They will not have a heartbeat. But their brains have somehow managed to preserve themselves. And so that was, you know, that is one criteria for continuing a code on a young child. Even though you don't have immediate response for quite some time, they will put them on a respirator and keep them alive.
Doctor, people who come back from things like that and other things similar, do they frequently have personality changes? I mean, I'm told, for example, that people who go through heart bypass surgery frequently come out with personality changes.
I think that's probably, with heart bypass in particular, it's a function of anesthesia. We don't realize how bad anesthesia, you know, how many side effects there are to it.
Oh?
I'll give an example of myself. I mean, I'm a pretty healthy person, and I went under general anesthesia to get some neck surgery done. Woke up, and I swear, I had memory problems for a whole month. I was not the same person. It really did take me 4 weeks to bounce back, to be able to think again, just to be able to, you know, reason my way through a story. And I hear this again and again from people that anesthesia really does take a lot of brain function away. Part of it is that it lingers in the body for quite some time.
Okay, you're thinking of it then as anesthesia's primary cause. I thought also perhaps the brain being deprived of oxygen for some period of time, you know, some parts. We don't know how the brain operates, right?
No, I mean, there's a lot of mystery involved. Now, with bypass surgery, there should not be that much of a, I mean, they should be maintaining your blood pressure and keeping your oxygenation up. I think that a large part of it is anesthesia.
Huh. Wow,
bypass,
that's a new one.
You know, being on the bypass machine is also bad for your brain as well.
I see. So many times what we think is death is just simply not necessarily death.
Well, you know, the traditional thing is your heart stops and you're not breathing, but real death to me is brain death. That's where our personality lies. It's in our brains.
Well, that begs the question then, and I will ask it, and that is, when we die, are you confident and comfortable that's it, that there is no thinking process that's continuing after apparent declared biological death? I don't want to know when I'm being carried away in the bag, when I'm going into the ice chest. You know, I don't want to know about that stuff. And I'm depending on the fact that we're gone, we're out, we're not, somehow the brain is not limping along at some percentage of saved up oxygen and still going.
Well, you know, you bring that up, and this is a nightmare that was actually awakened by my mother years ago. There are people who believe that after you die, you should wait 3 days for cremation.
Yes.
And I think that, of course, is one of the scariest ideas, is that maybe the brain, there's still something left in the brain when they put you into the crematorium. But I personally don't think that once you have gone without oxygen for that long, that there's much left. I don't think you're going to be aware of it.
Okay, but what about right after you've expired? I mean, let's say you have a heart attack and your heart stops or whatever other manner of death, but your head is okay and your brain is still there. My question is, how quickly would all functions that are associated with any kind of consciousness, how quickly would they cease? Immediately? 2 minutes? 30 seconds?
I would guess no longer than 2 minutes. Probably more like 15 seconds. Because you think about, just think about if somebody was to choke you,
yes.
How quickly do you lose consciousness? That happens within 20 seconds.
Yes.
So maybe there's some brain function, but you would not be conscious.
Well, perhaps in that manner of death, but they're not all the same. I mean, there are many, many ways to die, yes?
There are. I mean, I know what you're feeling. You are afraid of everything that we're all terrified of.
Of course.
And, I mean, the cases of people who have sort of near-death experiences who are coded but still feel they can hear things and see white lights and see the hallucinations that aren't not unusual for near-death experiences. That's still brain function. I mean, it just means that some neurons are firing and maybe you're awakening memories in the brain, but it just means that you are still conscious on some level, even though you're undergoing CPR.
And you attribute that. I've got a very good friend, Danian Brinkley, struck by lightning, declared dead, by the way, had an incredible NDE, a couple of them, actually. And where does that stuff come from? Is that NDE, according to what you believe, scientifically occurring either just as they're going down or just as they're coming back up, but not in that bottomless pit we call death?
There is a theory that it's all related to a lack of oxygen, that it's the hypoxic brain that comes up with what seems to be very consistent sorts of things, seeing lights, seeing a bright light, seeing people who you love who have died or passed on.
Don't those stories cause you to doubt a little? I mean, how could they not? They're so common. I also interview all these folks who study this at the top of their game, and they swear, how could any rational person listen to story after story after story and not at least have some doubt about what may be over there on the other side or not?
Again, that's why I consider myself an agnostic. I do not say that it's not possible, you know, that it's impossible. I think that it's near-death experience research is fascinating, but nobody has, it's one of those things you don't really have any way of proving it, do you, until you cross over?
No, you don't. But, you know, a person of science does have to take into account all of these unaccountably similar stories and make something out of it.
Well, one of the possibilities is, as I mentioned, it's a common hallucination for the hypoxic brain. Who knows?
Maybe.
I know. You know, Art, I grew up in a paranormal household. I don't know if I ever told you this.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did. My mother lived in a demon-haunted world, let's put it that way. She, we were members of the San Diego Parapsychology Association.
No kidding.
I grew up with mediums, psychic mediums, sitting around our dinner table, and we had people would go into trances over dessert in our house. I was surrounded by this. My mother would always tell me stories about ghosts that she had seen in China, and she firmly believes in ghosts because she has seen them herself. And
so have many of my listeners. I mean, yes. it's another area of interest. Obviously there cannot be ghosts if there are not spirits who live beyond death. So I have a great interest in these ghost stories, and there are millions and millions of them. Again,
there are, and I would love to see a ghost. I have been looking for a ghost all my life. And as a child, I always wanted to see one. Sorry, I never did, because I think that were I to see a ghost, were I to be convinced of that, it would be a great deal of comfort to me that there is evidence of life after death.
All right. We have been fascinated with the possibility of death not being the final toll for a long time. Actually, in reviving the dead, that was Frankenstein. And
yes.
Do you believe, Doctor, that it will ever be possible to revive the dead?
Well, that's where cryogenics comes in, isn't it? That's the only real way. We do not have the technological capacity to truly revive the dead right now.
Again, I've interviewed people who are paying substantial amounts of money to have either their head or whole body frozen upon their death to be brought back millennia in the future when whatever it is that killed them can be corrected. Are they crazy?
I wouldn't say they're crazy. I would say that they have a great deal of faith in technology, but knowing the practical aspects of keeping a body frozen for that long, and in terms of how many companies go out of business, I think they're probably wasting their money. I mean, just think about how here you have a giant freezer with 500 heads waiting to be awakened at some later century.
Yes.
And you go out of business. You go bankrupt.
What happens to the heads?
You're not going to keep those things frozen into eternity. You're just going to let them defrost.
Well, that's certainly a breach of contract.
It is a breach of contract, but once you're dead and gone in 50 years, are you going to be able to say that your heirs will keep up the cryogenic lab?
Well, I mean, people have this elaborate plan for invested funds, you know, that will keep it all going.
Well, you certainly hope that they would.
Let's go back to it. I mean, is there at least a slim possibility that science may find a way to reanimate the dead if they were properly preserved?
Yes, I think that there probably is, assuming you did not let the brain cells die. It has to be. This is part of, I think, their protocol is that they undergo cryogenics while they are still on life support before the brain actually goes. Once your brain is dead, there's no way to revive
it. The courts won't let them do it. There have been several who have tried. They say, you know, I know I'm terminally ill. I know I've got weeks or months or whatever. I want to go now. It's my only chance. And the courts have not let them do it.
Well, no, because it leads to what appears to be premature death, right? And it's almost like committing suicide in the eyes of a lot of courts.
I suppose.
Yeah.
But you're telling me that to be at least have a good hope of being revived, you would have to be put down. There is that term, put down.
While your brain is still functioning. That's a choice. I mean, are you willing to give up, say, 6 months of extra life for the possibility of waking up a century from now?
Would you be?
You know what? I would be waking up in a world where my loved ones were not with me if I had not cryogenically frozen them. To me, that's not worth living, actually. To think of having lost everybody you've loved. I mean, really, when you think about what is the purpose of life.
I don't know, maybe if you had enough, you were holding enough early Google stock, you know?
Oh, then you would be able to keep them going. If I could wake up 100 years from now and everybody I loved would still be here, that would be different. Hmm. But I think that to wake up in a future when your children are gone, your spouse is gone, everybody you care about is gone, I'm not sure that's worth coming back to.
Well, I imagine that a lot of attempts to revive the dead through centuries and centuries, Doctor, have been made. I just bet they've been done, and of course they're not publicized. right?
I don't know that. I think, you know what, Art? I think they would be publicized because there's a lot of money to be made.
Well, only if it's successful. I said attempts. I didn't say anybody had
done. Okay. All right. Attempts. Yeah, if they're successful, believe me, there would be a lot of publicity and a lot of people willing to pay millions of dollars.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. But my question is this. Are there and have there been through the centuries, do you believe, quiet attempts to revive the, let's call them the long dead?
No, I think once, unless you're going to count Jesus and Lazarus, but I just don't think that anybody really has felt that it was possible. And now, the recently dead, they have done. I mean, this is like really the whole basis for resuscitation, where we come up with the science of resuscitation. You know, way back in the 1500s, really, midwives were already using mouth-to-mouth on newborns. Mouth-to-mouth resuscitation goes back quite a ways, probably, you know, even before the 1500s. And I think what everybody got interested in was in the 1700s when galvanism came into play. This was something started off by Luigi Galvani, who found out that you could apply electrical currents to a frog's leg and make it twitch and it look like it was alive. And so people thought, oh, well, if you can make a frog's leg come back with electricity, maybe you can make the whole body come back. They didn't understand brain death at that
point.
The
inspiration for Frankenstein, no doubt.
The inspiration for Frankenstein. I mean, Frankenstein was published, I think, in 1813.
But so not such an outrageous theory, Doctor, because, frankly, if your heart stops, what do? They put those paddles on and
they
apply
sure
what?
Do.
They apply a lot of voltage and a lot of current.
They sure do, and that's what got everybody very excited because, and you know, Benjamin Franklin actually was one of the early proponents of using electricity to wake people up again. He was a brilliant man. He thought, well, why not? So, you know, the interest in electrical restimulation of the heart has been around for quite some time.